Yeah, who left precisely, at least as the text suggests, precisely because he didn't want to be in Zarahemla.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, that's a fascinating political move.
It is. You put the highest ranking Mulekite in charge of this reconciliation group. And to that reconciliation, intriguingly, notice that when he gets there, he gives him King Benjamin's discourse.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful theological discourse, but as I just said, has this completely political side to it. How do I take two people that are estranged and bring them back together?
In this episode, Dan Belknap and I are going to explore some elements of Nephite society. I guarantee that you are going to say again and again, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, that explains some things. And I encourage you to stay all the way to the end. It's a little bit of a long episode, but stay all the way to the end because we're going to apply some things to Christ in ways that you, I would guess you haven't thought of. Hello, and welcome to The Scriptures Are Real. This is the podcast where we talk about elements of the Scriptures that help them become more real to us because we believe that helps them apply them to our lives better and draw more power out of them as a result, and we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Kerry Muelstein, and I have with me a close friend and colleague and a returning guest, Dr. Dan Belknap. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
It's wonderful to have you with us. For our audience that has been around with us for a while, you'll be familiar with Dan. Last year, we did an episode on Hebrews together, one on 2 Corinthians, one on Romans together. He was a fan favorite. People loved having Dan on, mostly because he talked about black holes and jumping into them in a resurrected body. But I'd invite you to go back and listen to those, and you can also hear more of an introduction of Dan there. But I'll just tell you that he and I went to the same high school, though we didn't know each other there. We met at an intensive Hebrew program in Jerusalem. He went, so he also did his degrees, first two degrees at BYU, but then went to the University of Chicago and for a degree in Northwest Semitics, which includes Hebrew, but also things like Ugaritic, which is what Dan specializes in. So he's a Canaanite specialist, one of the few in the church, although I don't know what Canaanite really means. But anyway, he's just a fun, wonderful, great guy. And he has a fantastic wife, I should say that, and fun kids. So what else should we know about you, Dan?
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good sum up there. I do love the Book of Mormon. Obviously, that's a nice little segue into our discussion, but I really do love studying the Book of Mormon. So,
in fact, as good as Dan is at all sorts of other things that he does, and he's a ritual specialist and so on, I can remember him saying several times, well, I love all that other stuff, but I really did this because I love the Book of Mormon. And it's evident that he loves the Book of Mormon. So he's the perfect guy to have on. And especially for today's topic, Dave, if you'll remember, if you listen to some of our other episodes, Dan is one who thinks outside of the box, which is a fantastic gift. And that will be helpful. He's going to help us explore something that he and I independently have both thought about quite a bit. I think he spent a lot more time working on this than I have, but I've thought about quite a bit, and it's going to be a little bit of a different episode than we often do. So the reading for this week is Mosiah 29 through Alma 4, and we'll certainly talk about that reading, but we're not going to try and cover all the reading, and we're not going to try and stay confined to that reading. Instead, we're going to, so we may not end up talking about Nehor at all. We might. If we don't, then I'll invite you all. I'll end up doing on my Patreon website, so you can go to tsar.website to get there, but I will. I do daily thoughts, and I'll explore Nehor there. If we don't get to it here, I'll explore it there anyway. What we will really want to do is look at some things that we both think are going on in Nephite society that most of you may not have thought of, noticed, recognized, or you had some questions, didn't know what to think about it. And for me, this is part of how the Scriptures become real. When we can take, you know, we want to learn from the precepts that are taught in there, but I think we can learn better when we take a step back and say, well, what was going on in the lives of these people that made these things happen? And as they become more real, as we think about this was happening in their culture and this was happening in their society, those people become more real. And then we can recognize, well, things are happening in our culture and society. How does the precepts that we see in the Book of Mormon, how did that help them navigate what was going on in their lives? Then it can help us navigate things in our lives better. So we're just going to try and make this very real today by looking at some of those things that I think we see bubbling up in the text that aren't explicitly addressed, but they are made manifest nonetheless in the text. And I'll also say, I mean, there's just going to be a degree of speculation in what we talk about today. So we're just going to say that at the beginning, that we're piecing things together, but we can't say we know this happened for sure, or that happened for sure. And we're certainly not pronouncing doctrine about Nephite culture or society. But this is the kind of thing that I think was worth stopping and thinking about and making it real. So, Dan, what are some of the things that you see happening in society during this reading and elsewhere?
Well, and before we do that, I just wanted to just really reemphasize what you just said there, right? I think sometimes when we think of scripture study, it's and rightfully so, that we always talk about this as in terms of personal application, right? That how right. What am I supposed to get out of this? What am I supposed to do with it? And yet, I think sometimes we forget that whatever the message was actually had an original audience, yeah. Right? I get that Mormon's writing to a later generation. But Mosiah, King Mosiah's teachings and innovations, political innovations, had a direct impact on that particular culture at that time. And Alma's teachings fit within that. Christ in 3 Nephi isn't addressing you and I directly. He's addressing that audience directly, which then Mormon takes and uses for a later record. But I think sometimes we forget that we're not the original audience.
Yeah. And I find I can apply it to my life better when I can see how they applied it to their life.
That's exactly right. All right. So with that, the setup. So Mosiah 29 comes at an interesting pivot of what I look at in terms of Nephite history, right?
Yeah.
Mormon's giving us this marvelous 1,000-year, really brief summarized history of the Nephites. But there are plenty of times when he just all of a sudden telescopes in, condenses down, and looks at certain segments of Nephite history. And Mosiah 29 begins to open up one of those. Now,
and maybe I can interrupt there, Dan, just to say, and I don't know why I haven't thought to say this before on the podcast, but there are many people who have made a big deal of this, and I actually agree that we have a disproportionate amount of pages per year, you could say, per time, mm-hmm. for the 100 or so years right before Christ comes. And people have suggested that that's because as we learn about how Nephite society prepared for his first coming, we should apply that to how we prepare for the second coming. So again, I think it's doubly applicable for us to look at what's going on during that time period.
Well, and I've even looked at it from that's a useful model as we look at it in terms of our own preparations. From the book itself, it also happens to be the most transformative period of Nephite history.
Yes.
When you see this change, this political transformation that takes place in Mosiah 29, where we're moving from a monarchical system to whatever representative system the reign of judges is, right? And it's not 100% clear exactly what that all means, but that's a big switch.
Yeah.
And when you look at the Book of Alma, for instance, that's 100 pages of the Book of Mormon, but it only covers 40 years worth of Nephite history. Yeah. And it's the first 40 years of the reign of the judges. Right? Some project that I've worked on is I look at this end of the 17th to the beginning of the 19th year of the reign of the judges. That's Alma 30 through 42. That's 46. It's Alma 30 to 46 that covers a year and a half worth of Nephite history.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's something that's going on in these first 40 years, and this is so transformative and therefore filled with moments of crisis, right? That it's no surprise. You mentioned Nehor. Nehor takes place in the very first year of the reign of the judges and creates a crisis to this new political system that often gets left out. We go to the priestcraft, and we'll dive into this more a little bit later, but the political crisis that is created through Nehor is intriguing, and it just continues all the way till really Korihor and then Amalekiah and the war chapters after that. That the Book of Alma only covers 40 years worth of Nephite history is, I think, something that we lose often.
Agreed.
So in terms of what Mosiah 29, in some ways, Mosiah, not surprisingly, it's a perfect way to end a book. It both ends kind of a period of Nephite history and in many ways begins it. And for me, the understanding arises from an even earlier Nephite issue. So I want to set this up first, do it quickly, and then we can begin to see how the ramifications show up. And it's this, it goes to What I see is an overall concern that the Nephites have from the beginning of the book to the end of the book as to who exactly they are. There's an identity crisis for the Nephites. You can see it in Nephi's teachings in 1 Nephi chapter 19, and then the Isaiah chapters that he uses. Jacob's great speech, 2 Nephi 6 through 10, where you get his commentary on pretty much the same Isaiah stuff as Nephi, his brother did, but where they talk about, now, knowing these things, let us not hang down our heads, for we are not cast off, right? That's that there's a Nephite fear that they somehow don't fit the covenant pattern.
And in fact, I'll just remind my audience that we spoke about how each of those happen when they've just had a geographic move, and that probably brings up questions of how the promised land fits into the covenant and so on. And it does create a covenant identity crisis, or at least a question, a serious question.
It does. It's I think it's why you see so much discussion about redemption and redeeming in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
This doctrine that is often understood from a biblical perspective, that I will find you and bring you back, that there's always a return that's built into the concept of redemption in the Old Testament.
Right.
And for the Nephites, they're never going back.
Yeah.
And if you look at Deuteronomy 28 and the curses and the blessings that arise from that, scattering is a negative. Scattering is a sign of wickedness. Yeah. And the Nephite experience is one of constant scattering, or constantly going someplace new.
Yep. Yep. So, for them, that forces them to think about coming back, not as coming back to that promised land, but as coming back to God.
That's exactly right. Restoration. I've talked about it in my classes before, with the concept of the Book of Mormon establishes an idea of gathering as not a return. Yeah. The gathering is just a new place where you gather. Yeah. The allegory of the olive tree, those baby trees never actually return back. They stay out in the vineyard.
Yeah.
Right? And so you can see Christ. No. We're slightly off track now, but in 3 Nephi chapter 20, he will tell them, you really are children of the covenant. You're children of the prophets. You're children of Israel. But what he emphasizes when it comes to the Abrahamic covenant is, through thee and thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed.
Yeah.
Which is not, it's not the blessings part, it's the responsibility part.
Yep.
And explains, how am I supposed to bless all the nations of the earth if I don't actually scatter you? So the Book of Mormon establishes a positive scattering.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's constantly up against a biblical negative scattering, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So they've been in the land of Nephi, things are good, but then Mosiah opens, and Mosiah 1 is told by the Lord, you need to leave. And so they leave. They leave the land of Nephi, and they come to Zarahemla. Now, the Book of Mosiah establishes that there's a group of Nephites, apparently, right? Zeniff and this group, who do not feel that Zarahemla is where they should be, that this is not. So they attempt a biblical redemption. They actually attempt to return back to the land of Nephi. And I think they use Isaiah 52 as part of their justification to do so. So Abinadi gives us teachings about redemption, which intriguingly is about how Christ returned back to the Father and did so through submission. And anyway, long story short, all these Nephites end up back here in the land of Zarahemla, right? The challenge with this, though, and this leads to our next variation on this identity problem, is that the land of Zarahemla isn't uninhabited. It is inhabited.
Right.
And it's inhabited by another group of people, these Mulekites, right? The people of Zarahemla. And that's going to create some interesting cultural challenges. If you were to follow the biblical model and you come across, you're led by the Lord into a new land by people who don't know God, who don't understand these things, then if I'm following the Joshua model, what should I do?
You displace them. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's clearly not what the Lord's asking him to do, right?
Right.
There's an integration.
And especially because these are also Israelites. That's right. So and that is actually does fit into the biblical model a little bit, in that the Israelites are not allowed to displace the Moabites or Edomites or Ammonites, because they are descendants of Abraham as well. And so you can't of Abraham's nephew. But anyway, they're part of that group. And so the Israelites you integrate with and try and convert and that kind of a thing. Right.
Right. And so now we have got, but with that said, I've got a different culture. It's had 500 years worth of separation,
yep. right?
I assume, I don't know. I have no idea. This is where we start doing our assumptions, right? We have to play with some assumptions and as we reconstruct part of this, but Mulekite language, right? It's had 500 years of at least lingual drift from biblical Hebrew with, as far as we can tell, no biblical text to let them know what good biblical Hebrew is.
Yeah, and the Book of Mormon's pretty clear about that, that they don't have the written language, and so their language drifts,
That's exactly right. And I think, by the way, now this is my opinion, I don't think Nephites are speaking biblical Hebrew anymore.
Yeah, of course not.
Right? But I've got a record that allows me to know what biblical Hebrew is. I just don't think they have it. And I'm pretty sure that that biblical Hebrew isn't pointed, right?
Yeah.
So I
well, what's no more, we know that there's an at least Egyptian script, and maybe more than that, right? So that there are a number of things that so we can think of it this way: we're 500 years past King James English, and we've drifted quite a bit, and that's with a tremendous amount of written literature to keep us tied without drifting very much, right? Yep. And just think about the difference between us, or if you were in, say, Cockney England, or in Australia or New Zealand, right? So you can see all the different ways it can drift when we're all tied to the same text. Now give yourself a group that is less tied to a text and a text that's more difficult, and that's Nephites, and then give yourselves no text, and that's Mulekites.
That's exactly right. And I look at this and I go, if I were to use an English, King James English is difficult in and of its own. Go back a couple of centuries and you have Chaucer's English.
Yeah, or Beowulf.
And try listening to that, right?
Yeah.
So when they're like, well, we don't know what they're saying, I want to go, well, it's a common language. You're going to figure out how to do this. But for that first little while, no, of course, it sounds like a completely different language.
Yeah.
And I think you actually see elements of that, just on the side. I think the city Melek, right, that you have later in the Book of Alma. Well, Melek's clearly a Hebrew term. It's the word for king. But you also have a city called Mulek, right, where we're getting, and you and I both know it's the same Semitic root.
Yeah.
But we're looking at two different Semitic versions to this.
Yep.
And in fact, the Mulek version, I think, is the older Semitic version. Probably, if I were to guess, it's Phoenician, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With the secondary vowel that's thrown in, the schwaification of it all. But that's,
and I wouldn't be surprised, because my guess is that Mulek sails with the help of Phoenicians.
Yeah, exactly. So we have another Semitic influence there. Mm-hmm. That's not to, what if there were native populations that they encountered? Anyway, there's been lingual drift.
Yeah.
And Nephites and Mulekites don't necessarily speak the same language. What's intriguing is it's right about here, this time period, where Nephites start to brag about how they know they've been taught in the language of their fathers, right? That means absolutely nothing unless you're encountering another language.
Yeah.
Right? So we're already recognizing there's an element of the cultural to this aspect. Clearly, they've run into another language. Now, while we're in Mosiah 29, Mormon puts in this fun little demographic detail in Mosiah 25. When everyone gets back together, when Alma and his people in the church get together, when Limhi and his people, when they all get back to Zarahemla, they do this ritual that when you all meet back together, you tell everybody's stories in a public venue, right? Someone stands up, tells their story. Anyway, that's what they've done. Mosiah, of course, 25, King Mosiah 2 causes that all the people should be gathered together. Now, here's the demographic detail that Mormon puts in. Now, there were not so many of the children of Nephi.
What verse are you in?
Verse 2, chapter 25, verse 2, Mosiah 25.
Oh, that's what you meant. I thought you said Mosiah 2, or you meant the second King Mosiah, but you meant Mosiah 25, verse 2.
Mosiah 2, we've had Mosiah 1, led the land of Nephi, land of Nephi. His son Benjamin, now Mosiah 2, Benjamin's son. So chapter 25, verse 2. Now there were not so many of the children of Nephi, or so many of those who were descendants of Nephi, as there were of the people of Zarahemla, mm-hmm. who was a descendant of Mulek. Mm-hmm. So my demographics in the city of Zarahemla are that the Nephites are a minority.
Right.
Now I don't know if it's a sizable majority, a small majority, I don't know. But they're a minority with the people of Zarahemla, the people of Mulek, a majority.
Right.
Now, you and I have been in enough older cities to know that the layout of a city, right, particularly if you have a wall, what this would suggest is, of course, is that the people of Zarahemla and the people of Nephi really aren't living next to each other.
Yeah.
The idea of mixed neighborhoods is a relatively recent urban phenomenon. It's not an ancient one.
Yeah, the Nephites are going to have to build some place to live in the city or expand the city, probably similar to what happened in Jerusalem when you had a whole bunch of refugees come there. And so they'll be in their area that they build, and that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah. And like in any other urban environment, that minority can retain its customs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the majority is going to. So we often think about this as if the majority of everyone in Zarahemla speaks Nephite, because now we're talking back to languages, right? But the majority of the population isn't Nephite, it's Mulekite, which suggests to me that the elite might learn Nephite. And this is going to be an interesting phenomenon too. The Nephites end up in the elite positions.
Yeah, yeah, and I want to talk about that in just a second, but yeah, keep going. Yeah.
But the majority of the population is going to be Mulekite. They're going to keep speaking Mulekite, right? And if I'm a Mulekite, I'm not going to go into the new neighborhood to go to a Nephite baker. I've got a perfectly good Mulekite baker, and I've got a perfectly good Mulekite dressmaker, and I've got a perfectly good Mulekite pottery maker, right? Yep. And the Nephite's the same. Yep. These are going to remain two bifurcated communities in Zarahemla. And what you can see over the course of King Benjamin's discourse, this beautiful spiritual theological sermon, has a real political impetus too. You go back to Mosiah chapter 1, and when he tells his son, I want you to gather everyone, he actually says, and by that I mean these two groups of people, and when they do, I'm going to give them a new name, a name that will distinguish them above any other group out of Jerusalem, right? Yeah, he's got a problem. I've got two groups of people, and they're not really hanging out with each other. They don't see themselves as the same people. They're not one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, probably in some ways, yes. And in most practical ways, no.
Yeah. And so what is he trying to do? He's trying to create a unified people. And he's going to do that by giving him a new name. Now, it just so happens the new name is Children of Christ. But that Children of Christ is meant to smooth over all of these other cultural, social differences that exist.
Which is similar to what Paul was doing, right? Saying, okay, we've got all sorts of different cultures. We've got slaves and masters. We've got people from all over the place, but we can become one in Christ. And I think Benjamin's trying to do the same thing.
Isn't that what President Nelson's also been speaking about?
Yes.
How our identity is in our covenant identity. We don't want you to lose your cultural differences, but your primary identity is of covenant and oneness.
Yeah. Yep. And that should affect the way you treat everyone else so that there is a degree of unity, right?
That's exactly right. But so back to 25, notice this, right? Look down here in verse 4. Now, all the people of Nephi were assembled together and all the people of Zarahemla, and they were gathered together in two bodies.
Right.
We are three generations now into this integration, and they still separate out.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So one element of this story is that I've got really two groups of people in Zarahemla. I've got Mulekites and I've got Nephites, and they're not really integrating, at least the way King Benjamin or even Mosiah would prefer them to do.
Yeah.
Right? There's differences in language, which might explain why all of a sudden we have this, I was taught in the language of my fathers. Why that's a bragging, right? I don't go around bragging, hey, I was taught in the language of my parents. English is what I was raised in, right?
Yeah.
But my mom, who's a Swiss immigrant, can go, oh, no, I know Swiss, German, and English. That's a bragging right for her, right?
Yeah.
This isn't an issue until you encounter another language. And then this demographic number tells me the city is probably divided with what you said, a Nephite enclave and Mulekites elsewhere. And there's not really a lot of interaction. And then you've got this idea that the minority came in and became the elite.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Let's talk about that for a minute, if that's all right. Do you can go first if you want, or I can talk.
No, go for it.
So I one thing that I find to be astonishing is that the Nephite king ends up being king over all of them for a couple of reasons, somewhat because they're a minority, although they do one thing they have is that they've got written records and this language that's kind of preserved from their written records. And so that's fine. But the reason to me it's so astonishing is we know that Mulek was a descendant of David. And that means Zarahemla is a descendant of David, or even Ammon. And I think sometimes we miss this, not Ammon, Mosiah's son, but the other Ammon who goes back to people of Zenith. I think part of the reason he's sent is because you've got a descendant, a son of a king, that you need to give him something to do, right? He's got to be in charge of something, but in charge of something that's not harmful to you and your court and so on. But in any case, I think sometimes we underestimate, at least in the biblical world, the power of the Davidic covenant, that there is supposed to be a descendant of David on the throne. And that ends in most ways with the Babylonian captivity, right? You do get Zerubbabel, who comes back and is the first governor. He is a descendant of David, and that's part of why he's the first governor. But it doesn't end with the Mulekites. The Davidic dynasty is alive and thriving in the new world with the descendants of Mulek, including all the way up to Zarahemla, right? So if you have these two come together, just as a biblical scholar, if you were to tell me you've got two groups of Israelites that come together and one of them has a leader who's the descendant of David, I would say, well, then, duh. He becomes the king of everyone. That's a no-brainer. That's a dove. He's the one who's prophesied will be king, who God has said should be king. And it is astonishing to me that it happens elsewise. Now, I think that God is obviously involved in that, or it wouldn't have happened that way. But I think we have to keep our eye on that as we move forward, that we have descendants of David among the Mulekites who have pretty legitimate claims to kingship. And I think we're going to see that keep bubbling up as well.
Well, and to that extent, right? Again, if we use our biblical model, what should Mosiah have done if you need it? Because to your
Mosiah point, 1 or Mosiah 2?
Mosiah 1. I mean, this is to your point, this is going to bubble up. In fact, we're going to see it in Helaman chapter 1, right?
Yeah.
So where we find a descendant of Zarahemla, the last we've got Mulekite royalty all the way into the 40th year of the reign of the judges, creating problems.
Yep.
So if you're going to follow the biblical model, what does David do to make sure that he doesn't have any of these dynastic issues?
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, he wipes out Saul's family.
Yep.
Oh, God told me to do it, right? And I'm like, right, it's also a political expediency, right?
Yep.
But clearly, you're not going to do it here. So to your point, when they go back to find that group of lost, estranged Nephites, right, back in the land of Nephi, who's in charge? A Mulekite who's never been there before? That's who you put in charge?
He's going back to get the Nephites who aren't Mulekites and who are distancing themselves from Mulekites.
Yeah, who left precisely, at least as the text suggests, precisely because he didn't want to be in Zarahemla.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating political move.
It is. You put the highest ranking Mulekite in charge of this reconciliation group. And to that reconciliation, intriguingly, notice that when he gets there, he gives him King Benjamin's discourse, which is a beautiful theological discourse, but as I just said, has this completely political side to it. How do I take two people that are estranged and bring them back together?
Yeah. And the answer is through Christ, but it needs to be done.
It needs to be done. And so, and I think that's his political job. I'm the ambassador telling you, you can come back. So when Lehi says, well, why don't you baptize this? And Ammon's like, whoa, no, that's, I'm here for political reasons. I'm not here for theological ones. But the king can do that when you get back there.
Yeah. In fact, it almost implies, and this is seriously speculation, but it almost implies that the realm of priesthood remains among Nephi's descendants. And we don't really see high priests or anyone leading the church, something who's not a descendant, not just of Nephites, but of Nephi or Jacob. Right. Yeah. And so it's almost this biblical model. You have to be a descendant of Aaron. Yeah. You have to be a descendant of Nephi or Jacob. And this may also be, I never thought of this before, but this may also be part of what gives the Nephites a little bit of leverage as they come in and become kings, because Mulek, unless he has some Levites with him, they're not going to have anyone who is feeling like they are priesthood authorized. Right. But the Nephites have certainly created priesthood authorization. We assume that's through Lehi, and I assume through the Melchizedek priesthood. I have colleagues that would say, no, it doesn't have to be, and I don't know. But they've certainly got priesthood, and that that is an important and powerful role that they continue to play.
It is. And in fact, it's going to become an item of resentment as we move into the reign of the judges. It's the church and the priesthood, by virtue of that, temples and offerings and all of that, is going to be have a Nephite hegemonic level of leadership.
Yeah.
And this is and where I'm going to have to start talking about Nephite this way, because at the same time,
for our audience that can't see, he's doing air quotes.
So. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I can see it in the video. But we're going to have to talk about Nephite this way, because not only do I have a Nephite language, which we can call Nephite,
right?
Where this is at the same time, it's going to start talking about traditions of the fathers. At the same time as we're encountering a new culture, all of a sudden there's a dialogue as to what the traditions of the fathers are. And you can see that one definition that's going to be in Mosiah 27, and one's going to be in Alma chapter 3. And these are going to define Nephite and the traditions of the fathers moving forward. And you're going to find the people of Ammonihah going, those are your traditions. Korihor, those aren't my traditions. The Zoramites, we don't believe in the traditions of our brethren. This, all of a sudden, this debate about priesthood, and again, I'm all over the place, Carrie, but you mentioned priesthood. You look at the Zoramites in Alma chapter 31, and you look at that prayer closely, it uses the word holy more than almost any other part of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Outside of when the Book of Mormon talks about the priesthood. And what it suggests then is the Zoramites see themselves perhaps as a reform movement for a priesthood that they feel has gone astray in Zarahemla.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, certainly they think they've gone astray religiously. They're saying that overtly, right?
Yes.
But that's got to be packed with ideas of rituals, and that's got to be packed. I mean, they're in the middle of a ritual when they say it, right? So that's got to be packed with priesthood.
It's that word holy. And holy is not used in just omnipresent situations in the Old Testament. It's associated with temple, and it's associated with priesthood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and ritual.
And ritual. And that's where you find it. So, all right. So back here to this Nephite minority, right? So I think part of it is they've got the record. I think to your point, I think part of it is they have the priesthood. I also think there's a very almost prosaic secular thing that they have. Of the groups in the Book of Mormon, the Nephites have the best facility with working with metal. They're metal workers. They're a small minority that use metal. And on just a practical level, that is a skill set that puts them heads and shoulders above any other group in the Book of Mormon. It means they're going to be the most sophisticated in warfare. It means they're going to be the most sophisticated. They're going to have the best high elite cultural items, gold, silver, right? I mean, they've got a tool set. If you look at here in the text, that they are able to distinguish between copper and bronze. Bronze is an alloy, iron and steel. They know how to make steel. There's nobody among the Amalekites, as far as I can tell, that know how to make steel. And no Lamanite that I know of can make steel. It's the Nephites who have that skill set.
And just to help our audience put this, I guess, in context, this is in the ancient world, including in the Bible, this is something that often does stratify. This is the Philistines had an upper hand on the Israelites for quite a while because of their metalworking ability, and they wouldn't allow the Israelites to develop a metalworking ability and so on. It's consistently something that gives a culture an advantage over another culture in the ancient world.
Yep. So I look at this and I go, they are technologically superior to any other group in the Book of Mormon. So no surprise that they get elevated. So all the other reasons, throw in this technological advantage, and they become the elite.
Yeah.
And if so...
But there are still some Amalekites who consider themselves elite, and I think we're going to keep seeing
that.
You
can't get rid of the royal family unless you pull a David and just wipe out the entire dynastic line.
Right. Well, it's not just David. We see it all throughout Israelite history. It's all over the place in the kingdom of Israel. Yeah, right? And we see it in Jaredite history. This is just how people operate.
Right. Yeah. That's just
unfortunately
what you got to do. And again, to your point, since they don't, what are you going to do? Well, in the case of Mosiah 2, he makes Ammon his attaché, his cultural attaché to a group of Nephites.
Yeah.
40 years later, Coriantumr is going to become head of the Lamanite army.
Yeah.
right?
Yep.
And when he does, fascinatingly, he'll drive straight to Zarahemla and just pretty much just park.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So that's a lot's going on. And from that, you start to see this tradition of the fathers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is all leading to some backup. So if we go to chapter 26, Mosiah 26. Okay, now, this becomes, again, it's theological, but what I want to emphasize is, as you've done and what we're talking about here, is that these are traditions that are emerging from the Nephite population, not the Mulekite population. Right?
Right.
I don't think we think much about this, but the Book of Mormon doesn't really ever give us a Mulekite prophet, for instance.
And I mean, I would guess just that the audience is saying, okay, hang on, I haven't ever thought of this stuff. So again, I'll suggest, how many of you ever noticed that it said they were gathered together in two bodies, right? Right. It's, you have to start noticing these details to see this is going on. And again, we don't know how much integration there is. There's got to be a degree of integration, especially among the elite, the administrative units, right? There has to be a degree of integration. But it's also clear that there's a high degree of not integrating. And if you look at cultures around you today where we have two different ethnic groups coming in contact with each other, you see that's what happens almost anywhere you go. That's why you find little Chinas somewhere or whatever else, right?
Right. And keep in mind that I don't want to say it's mistrust, but not trusting him immediately isn't a surprise either.
Never happens.
No, I look at the Book of Romney, and when King Mosiah is king, at some period afterwards, you brought that Stella, that Jaredite Stella, mm-hmm. to him. Mm-hmm. Where was it when he became king? Right? Was Coriantumr still alive and you hid him from the Nephite king and the Nephite minority? Was he gone, but the Stella was never? I mean, that's just an interesting, for lack of a better term, state secret that they don't give to Mosiah I until they feel they can trust them.
Yeah. Yep. And it is interesting that, I mean, you bring up another thing. The Mulekites have had that little teeny touch of contact with the Jaredites, which Hugh Nibley will make kind of a big deal of. And I think rightly so, that you see there's a Jaredite influence among most of the dissenters from Nephites. And that's likely coming through the Mulekites, who are the ones that had contact with Jaredite culture.
Well, and in fact, just because of certain terminology that you see in Alma 30, for instance, Korihor makes the case that he does not believe in the tradition of your fathers, mm-hmm. to Alma. He does not believe that that tradition is his. Korihor, that name, take out the K and put in a C, and it's a Jaredite term.
Exactly right.
Is it
possible? And we see that in a number of places where that looks like a Jaredite name.
Yeah. So you look at that and you wonder, is Korihor Mulekite?
Yeah, and probably so.
Because he doesn't, or is he a disaffected Nephite who's like, this tradition isn't mine. I refuse to accept this tradition. And that's fine. He clearly doesn't see himself as quote unquote Nephite.
Yeah.
So to those traditions, Mosiah 26, it begins here. Now it came to pass that there were many of the rising generation, this is verse 1, that could not understand the words of King Benjamin being little children. And we know that. But notice that he goes on to say, and they did not believe the tradition of their fathers,
mm-hmm.
right? They did not believe what had been said concerning the resurrection of the dead, nor did they believe concerning the coming of Christ. Now, I know that those are two theological principles. These are two doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
But what's intriguing about it is they're being associated with the traditions of the fathers, and neither one of those are Mulekite doctrines. In other words, these are teachings that you find in the Book of Mormon through the small plates.
Yeah.
These are Nephite things that they bring to the table.
Yeah. Resurrection, possibly, it's tough to know, but the clear understanding of the coming of Christ, that comes from Lehi and Nephi's teachings.
Well, but look at even verse 2 with resurrection. It's not just that they don't believe in resurrection. Yeah. They don't believe in what has been said.
Good point. Okay, good. Very, very good.
Right?
Yeah. So, and we have, you know, precious little about resurrection in the Old Testament, but quite a bit in the Book of Mormon.
and it's Nephite prophets that are doing it.
Yeah.
So by this time, we're starting to see the church that came, by the way, from that group of what I'm going to call ultra-nationalist Nephites that went back to reclaim the land of Nephi,
mm-hmm.
Abinadi and Alma. And they, by the way, continue this message of redemption that Nephi and Jacob and the others had been teaching prior. I'm not so sure that Mulekites taught redemption because they don't have a biblical text.
Right.
And even if there's an influence of Phoenicians don't care about that. They don't have a doctrine of redemption.
Yep. And let's also be clear. So Mulek is a son of Zedekiah. And Zedekiah is not known as the most devout king we've ever had. I mean, he's not the worst, but no. He's not the most devout king that we've ever had. So it's hard to know even what Mulek's beliefs would have been as he comes.
Right. Okay, now, so with those two things, that the belief in what has been taught about resurrection of the dead and that Christ is coming, two very Nephite. Now, I don't know how to phrase this right, but if you have, okay, ultimately, this comes down to authority, and the Nephites have claimed authority.
Mm-hmm.
They've got some technological authority. They certainly have spiritual authority, and now they've got prophetic authority, right?
Yeah.
The Nephites hold a lot of authority. And so if I'm a Mulekite, and you say, this is, when the Nephites suggest certain things within the church or power or whatever, it's based on this prophetic authority. And if you don't accept that prophetic authority, this just looks like Nephites trying to take over.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So yeah. Even as
and prophetic and priesthood authority, let's throw that in. Yeah. And if you don't believe, accept that, then again, it looks like Nephites like, oh, well, they made up that whole priesthood thing so that they could take over, which is the same thing that Laman and Lemuel were saying, right?
That's exactly right.
Which is why you'll find a lot of dissenters really, they have an affiliation with Laman and Lemuel because they'll have some of the same complaints.
Yeah.
And I mean, with the Lamanites, I should say, not with Laman and Lemuel, but the Lamanites.
The purpose of authority then is to maintain that authoritative position.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly Korihor's critique.
Yep.
Exactly Korihor's critique. Okay, so Alma 4. Now, this is dealing with a particular event that took place in about the, what, third, fourth, fifth year of the reign of the judges. And Mormon is giving us a little background about to these Nephite dissenters who take upon themselves a mark, and that was fulfillment for them of this mark that is placed on the Lamanites. But you get down here to verse 11, where he gives a little bit more about maybe some of these, what it means to be the tradition of the fathers. And it would come to pass that whosoever would not believe in the tradition of the Lamanites, but believed in those records which were brought out of the land of Jerusalem. By the way, who brought those records out?
So you're in Alma 4:11?
Alma 3, my bad. Alma 3, verse 11.
Sorry, go ahead.
So notice, those who did not believe in the tradition of the Lamanites, but believed those records which were brought out of the land of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Nephites,
so that means there are only some, right? Exactly right, Nephites.
And also the tradition of their fathers, which were correct. Who believed, talking about the fathers, or even these, in the commandments of God and kept them, these are the people called Nephite.
Right.
Right? But, and so a Nephite obviously can be anyone, even if you're not a descendant of Nephi.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're
Lehi.
Or Lehi.
Yeah.
But it does mean that you have to accept the Nephites brought the record.
Yep.
Right? That the Nephites have that record, that the Nephites know what the commandments of God are. All of this emphasizes Nephite control.
Right. That tradition that they're the religious traditions of their fathers. And note how Mormon, who is a descendant of Nephi, by the way, but anyway, Norman says, which were correct, right? He's saying, yeah, they had, and they were, right? The teachings, the Nephite teachings about God, Christ, priesthood, temple, rituals, everything else were correct.
Right.
But
to do it,
yeah,
to make that claim for them to be correct required the Nephites to have authority.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's fine when you're all just Nephite and descendants of Lehi. But the minute you bring in another group of people who have their own line of authority, this is going to get tricky.
And pretty serious authority as well, right? Yeah. A different kind, more political, less religious.
Exactly. And so that kind of all finally takes us back to Mosiah 29.
Yeah.
Right? So with these cultural things and everything that's going on, you finally get 29. Now, in Mosiah 29, this is going to be the Mosiah 2 suggesting, let's change over this political system then. And I think part of that is a result of the now heterogeneous nature that he's got to the city of Zarahemla, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't get rid of these communities. I can't get rid of these cultures. And I don't want to. The Lord's not asking me to. How are we going to govern it? Not to mention, they've read the Jaredite record and his sons are gone, right?
Yeah.
So his sons being gone, we got a problem. And his problem, I think, of being influenced by the Jaredite record, as he says down here in verse 6 or 7, I went and asked you who you want as your king. And my son Aaron, my firstborn, is who you chose. But unfortunately, he's gone, right? Yeah. And my fear is that if we call someone else, if we choose someone else or appoint someone else, verse 7, behold, I fear there will arise contentions among you. And who knoweth? Now, keep in mind, the last that he really saw his sons was after this conversion with the angel.
Yeah.
But he's had years of them being whatever they were, dissenters.
Yeah. Yep.
So he's like, I don't know where Aaron is, and I don't know where he's going to be in 5 years. Who knoweth if my son comes back to whom the kingdom doth belong and should turn and be angry and draw a part of this people after him?
Yep.
And then we have contentions, exactly like we just saw from that Jaredite record people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's right. He has just finished translating it, and he knows how this worked with Jaredites, and it was an ugly mess.
Everybody does, because guess what you do is to that ritual when you come across a new community?
Yeah.
You make a public meeting and we sit down and read everybody's records and find out what happened.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. I mean, we can also say when he says that, you know, if another is appointed in his stead, behold, I fear there would rise contentions among you. I mean, how prophetic is that? Because we get that in Alma too, right? That's right on the horizon. It's going to happen.
Exactly. Now, with that said, he's got the issue of the immediate issue of descendancy and dynasties and all that. But he begins to point out another problem. And it's down here. If you look at verse 13, if it were possible that you could have just men to be your kings who would establish the laws of God and judge this people according to his commandments, yeah, if everyone could be like my father Benjamin, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
But he then says, but I can't guarantee you will always have a king like that.
Yeah.
And if you don't, notice down here in verse 20, 21, 22, I say unto you, you can't dethrone an iniquitous king, save it be through much contention and the shedding of much blood.
Yeah. For behold, and he goes on about that for a while. Keep going, yeah.
For behold, he hath his friends in iniquity, and he keepeth his guards about him, and he teareth up the laws of those who have reigned in righteousness before him. Ah, and this is where he gets to the point of something kind of important. A monarch is not beholden to the law.
Yeah.
As he points out, a bad king does not feel bound by law. Right?
Yeah. Good kings do, bad kings don't.
Right. But that's the kicker. Good kings do, but they still don't have to.
Mm. Right.
A monarch supersedes law.
Right.
They can do whatever they want. Now,
make law.
Yeah. A good king will set up this so that, no, I'll keep the law. But even a good king doesn't have to do that.
Well, to your point, Mosiah is changing the law as he's speaking here, right? He is changing the entire system of government because he can, because he's the monarch.
Exactly.
Now, he's trying to get buy-in from the people.
Right.
But because he's a good king.
And your bad king's the obvious evidence of that, because a bad king will just go, law, who cares? I'll do whatever I want.
Right.
But the intriguing part of that is, of course, a good king doesn't have to do it either. So the new system that he sets up is, let's get rid of monarchs. And this, whatever the system is with the judges, what it does is it puts the law top.
Right.
Right? This is rule of law.
Right. And it's... Go ahead. No, you go ahead. I'm going to segue just a teeny bit.
I was just going to say, the rule of law is what now is, that's what determines things. Personality is going to, maybe this is however you're going to choose these judges, but they still have to follow the law. The law is now first and foremost. You can't go about changing that as opposed to a monarch.
Yeah.
And so, so changing over from a monarchical system to a rule of law system, that's hard to do. That is hard to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Very, very, very hard. And I think you've kind of hinted at this a few times, as you say, you know, whatever that system is, most of my students, at least, have just kind of assumed that they're moving to a democracy that's similar to democracies in our world today. And that's not an assumption we can make. We don't know enough. I mean, you get a couple little clues that it's not when you see that Alma is able to choose who his successor is, right? Yeah. That's not an election. He chooses who's this. So it's not exactly what we are looking for. And so I just caution our audience to kind of not impose your own culture onto them. I don't know exactly what the system of judges looks like. It doesn't look like what we have. It doesn't look like a monarchy. It's somewhere, I don't know if even in between is what it is, but it's somewhere out there.
It's representational at some level, but it's not like ours.
Yeah.
And one of the areas that I'm fascinated with, I have never really fully did a full dive in, or at least I haven't written about it, but whatever this voice of the people is.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it sounds like a democratic decision, and other times I'm like, who the heck is the voice of the people?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The treaty that is given to the anti-Nephi Lehis in Alma chapter 26, when it comes back, it says, and the voice of the people decreed. And I'm like, who?
Yeah.
Who wrote this?
Yep. And I have to think of, there are a couple interesting times in Israelite history, not long before Mulek leaves, where you get some pretty serious political things happening done by the people of the land, is the phrase that it's used.
Yes.
And everyone's like, who are the people of the land? What does that mean, right? But they're making kings at times. Yeah. But we don't know who it is, right? So is this something, they probably understood how that worked. Is this something similar to that, whatever that is? We don't know.
No idea. And even when we speak of it, it's not even monolithic. I'm trying to remember the verse. If I had enough time, I'd look it up. But Captain Moroni, mm-hmm. to receive greater martial power in light of the rebellion of Amalekai and everything else, mm-hmm. goes to the voice of the people to get that power.
Yeah.
And then that has to be decided by the voice of the people.
Yeah.
Like, what? I got two different voices of the people? What's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah.
So whatever the system is and however it works, we don't know. But it is replacing a monarch, and it is dependent upon the law.
Yeah, that's the real key. And Mosiah sets up that law.
That's exactly right. Now, to the system itself, before we dive into all of the reasons why he wants to create that. The system itself, being made up of judges, has tiers of these judges, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the lower judges are more in number than the higher judges, because it works as a pyramid with the chief judge who's at the top, who kind of judges all these things. Now, in light of that, the judges, even though we're not told exactly, it suggests that the tiers of judges are going to be based on geographical areas, at least to some degree. If the mm-hmm. chief judge is responsible for the entirety of everybody, then the lower judges aren't. And yet the people are, right?
Yeah. So we see that when they bring, Korihor, who do they bring bound? And it's from one city to another city and so on, right? So we see that it's operating at least at a city level.
Exactly. Now, the reason why that's a big deal is, let's go back to our demographics, right? This system does something that hasn't existed for three generations at least in the integrated society, and possibly long before that, which is, you've just given political power, right,
mm-hmm.
to groups that have maybe never had it or haven't had it for generations. Because if the smaller judges are based on smaller groups of people and geographical area, and the city of Zarahemla has a Mulekite section and a Nephite section, now all of a sudden I can have Mulekite judges, at least on the lower end of things, and Nephite judges, as well as Nehorites, as well as whatever. You get what I'm saying by that?
Well, cities that, and we see this, people that move off and start their own city, they suddenly have their own power. And let's go back to a little demographic point to really understand this. Remember, there were more Mulekites than there were Nephites. Plus, that was true. And then a whole bunch of Nephites moved away and a whole bunch of them got wiped out. Well, some came back. There was a lot of wiping out that happened with this group that went down, Zenith's group, right? So if it ends up being by you know, cities or different areas, but with how many are in there. And I don't know if it is that way or not. But if it is, then suddenly the Mulekites actually have more judges than the Nephites.
At least on the lower end of things. And this is where part of this problem comes in. Again, to the point that it's probably not exactly like ours.
Yeah.
Somehow Nephites still are at the very top.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. We see them as the generals. We see them as the chief judges. We see them as the religious leaders.
It's still there.
Yeah. All the way down to Mormon. Positions.
Pardon?
All the way down to Mormon. I mean, it just stays that way consistently.
Yep. All the way down. So it's great, but it's still based on this rule of law thing. Now, this just means all of a sudden groups have political power that they haven't had before, right? Mm-hmm. And legitimate power that they didn't before. This isn't us acting separate from the monarchy. This is, you're now part of the system, which is great, but that's going to create its own set of problems. Okay. Now, to another reason why King Benjamin does, or King Mosiah does it, look down here in verse 30, 31, 32 of Mosiah 29, and I've always been struck by this. Now, I command you to do these things in the fear of the Lord, and I command you not to do these things, that you have no king, that if these people commit sins and iniquities, they shall be answered upon their own heads. Okay. That's agency.
Yeah.
For behold, I say to you, the sins of many people have been caused by the iniquities of their kings. Therefore, their iniquities are answered upon the heads of their kings. Now, I think we understand that principle, but he is what?
A king.
He's a king.
Yeah.
So we'll look at that. And now I desire that this inequality should be no more. And I'm like, what inequality?
Yeah. And well, go ahead.
Well, the inequality that a king, that one person bears the iniquities for everybody.
Exactly. And you see Benjamin talking about that. Like he feels this weight and this burden, like, I don't want your blood on me.
Yep.
So I'm going to have this meeting and so on. But
yeah.
I think you're right that the kings themselves feel it's unequal, not in their favor.
That's exactly right. A good king feels that way. A bad king doesn't care.
Yeah, that's right.
But a good king is like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's not my fault. You should be paying for your own mistakes or consequences. That's the inequality.
Yeah.
Mosiah looks at this and says, there's an inequality that the king bears the brunt of this.
Yep.
Now,
and by the way, when I teach second half of the Old Testament, one of the things we have to deal with repeatedly is how much the people follow their king.
Yep.
When you have right, and so maybe they always had righteous kings among the Nephites. I don't know, but Mosiah can certainly look at the biblical record and see whenever there was a righteous king, the people were righteous. Whenever there was a wicked king, the people were wicked. And it shouldn't be that top-down model. That's unequal.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And has his own experience behind this too, right? And now on a slightly more contemporary aside, how many times, because you and I are not kings, but we do have authority, right? And I'm not talking ecclesiastical authority. I'm talking academic authority, scholarly authority. And how often, though, are we then in some ways held accountable to that authority?
Mm-hmm.
People, you speak, I know people do this with you, Carrie. When you speak, it comes with a level of authority. And people are more likely to inherently just accept what you say precisely because you have that authority.
Yeah, and it does feel a burden. Like I recently said something on the Follow Him podcast that I don't remember having said, that is just kind of my opinion. And I'm getting all sorts of questions right now, like, hey, I believe that, but how do you know that, right? But I'm only getting it from a few people. Most probably just said, okay. And I'm thinking, did I say that? I shouldn't have said that. Because I need to be more careful. That's why we've started out saying we're speculating here, because we want to be careful about the use of that authority.
Exactly. So authority just brings it with it. And ecclesiastical authority does it too, right?
Mm-hmm.
The responsibility for President Nelson, you and I both know that come conference time, their talks are read by one another and reviewed,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. They read each other's stuff precisely so that they catch stuff that so they don't say anything that gets misconstrued. And yet it still gets misconstrued.
Yeah.
Right. I was in a meeting with Elder Bednar once, and it was opening, as they often do, leading to that question and answer after the initial presentations. And he says, but he gave us this instruction. He said, now, I don't want you to write down what I say. I don't want you to take notes of what I say.
Yeah.
Two reasons. One, I want you to write down your own revelatory process. He says, but two, you're going to inadvertently write it down wrong. And then I'm going to have to go do the damage control.
Yep. Yeah.
In any case. So there's that inequality. Now, I desire that this inequality should no more be in this land, especially among this, my people. But I desire that this land be a land of liberty and every man enjoy his rights and privileges alike. But that those rights and privileges have to be connected back to what he just talked about in verse 31 and 30 and verse 30, which is you ultimately are responsible for your behavior.
Very good.
Right? And in fact, when you look over here at verse 37 and 38, now it came to pass after King Mosiah had sent these things forth among the people, they were convinced of the truth of his words. Therefore, they relinquished their desires for a king and became exceedingly anxious that every man should have an equal chance throughout all the land. We do that and we go equality or maybe even equity, an equal chance in all the land. But notice what Mormon says. Yay. Every man expressed a willingness to answer for his own sins.
Yep.
It's the responsibility of agency that they have had an unequal opportunity to experience.
Good. And again, and this kind of, I guess I should have said this earlier when I was talking about the biblical example, but I would guess at least part of the reason they're thinking of this is the example of King Noah. They certainly have that example, right? Yeah. Where there were a lot of people who were apparently very steeped in sin, and it's only partially their fault, right? And that's part of the issue they're trying to fix here.
Yeah, and I'm always struck by this version of equality, and equal, or your rights are tied directly to your responsibilities.
Yes,
and I know that President Oaks has talked about this. I know Elder Christofferson has talked about it, probably because they're both from a legal background.
Yeah.
But they've talked about the importance of, in terms of agency, of your responsibilities rather than your privileges.
Mm-hmm.
That the privileges are there, but it requires your responsibilities.
You're absolutely right. Mormon is making it very clear here that that's what he's talking about.
Exactly. And this will come back to play in about 18 years when Korihor, again, I hate skipping ahead, but in Alma 30, this is Korihor's argument. You keep these people down that they durst not enjoy their rights and privileges. When you look at Korihor's teachings, notice they're all about your ability to do whatever you want.
Yep.
You're fair according to the management of the creature. You prosper according to the genius. There's no sin. There's no crime. Korihor's teachings on so many levels look good and meritorious in the sense that it's a meritocracy, right? Everyone has the same equal chance, but what he avoids are the responsibilities. There's no social responsibility. You can do whatever you want, regardless of anybody else.
Yep. Yep. You don't care about the effect on anyone else.
Right. And this, by the way, will go all the way through to the Gadianton robbers. Mm-hmm. And you get to 3 Nephi chapter 6, which it's one line, but after books of this stuff, beginning all the way here with Mosiah, you read about these organizations. I call them anti-Zion organizations, but in 3 Nephi chapter 6, they end up taking over all of Nephi government, right?
Yeah.
And want to install a king, right?
Yes.
Return back to a monarchy. So much of everything from Alma all the way to 3 Nephi 6 as pro-monarchical movements get rid of this rule of law and get back to a monarchy. Right.
Which I suspect is tied into that whole Davidic kingship thing. In at least one place, you can see the evidence for it, and the others, like Amlici, doesn't say anything about it, but I suspect it's there. It's just the kingmen that you can see it's there.
Well, and I think the Gadianton robbers are tied back to the Jaredite record, which was all a monarchy.
Yeah.
I think they use the Jaredite record to validate their existence.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so 35:6. It goes into this, how they've taken over it. And look at verse 30 for just a second. And they did set at defiance the law and the rights of their country.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time that clause is ever used in the Book of Mormon, rights of their country. Everything else has been about your rights and privileges, right? That's been the discussion with Korihor and elsewhere. Mormon here points out, yeah, but those rights and privileges of the individual are completely dependent upon the responsibilities that you have concerning your people.
Yeah.
The rights of the country.
Yeah.
And as you'll go on to say in chapter 7, having completely destroyed the political system and rule of law so that they can have a king, verse 1, now, behold, I will show you that they did not establish a king. How could you? You destroyed the system.
Yeah. Yep.
So, anyway.
And I think so much of this we're seeing, I just kind of said it, but I want to say it again. From Amlici wanting to be a king to the Malachi and the kingmen and everyone else, I think that these are the subcurrents of trying to get these two societies together. You've got one that feels they have a right to kingship, but the other had the kingship, and then you changed it to a different kind of government and so on. When you have someone who's saying they are of high birth, what does high birth mean among Nephites? You're all descended from the same people, but if you have a descendant of David, that's high birth and so on, right? Now, maybe I'm putting too much into that, but that's at least, I think, what we're seeing here.
I think that is part of it. I think there's also some practical elements that lie behind that. And what I mean by that is, okay, so now you've got a new system. Ideally, mm-hmm. It looks great. Everybody has a voice in some fashion, right? Mm-hmm. We've got a rule of law that's established. This is all good. But it brings up interesting questions. For instance, who's going to run the military?
Yeah.
Who's going to make sure that the roads are taken care of? Right? I don't know if there's any postal system whatsoever. But who's going to make sure that communications between communities takes place?
Yeah, there has to be something like that.
Right? Who's going to police? Is there a police force? Police and the military are two different things.
Yeah.
Right? Who's it? In terms of a military, the great thing about a monarch is that one centralized authority allows for an immediate response. He can muster up and call up like that. But under a judgeship, what if the other judges don't want their communities to be engaged?
Yeah.
Right? It requires a lot more cooperation and talking and working with each other, yep. which are time consuming. And in a crisis moment, could cause a problem.
Yep. And it does.
Right?
It does cause problems.
It does cause problems.
You see that, and with Captain Moroni is not happy about that.
But no. And in fact, look over anything, just comparative historic history. How well has any country done the first 20 years when they make the switch from monarchy to some type of representation in government?
Mm. Yeah, it's tough.
None do well.
Yeah.
So no shocker to me that for the first 18 years, it's a mess of Nephite history. Yeah. It's an absolute mess. There's crisis after crisis after crisis.
Yep.
Right? Not the least of which is the very first one in chapter 1 of Alma.
Yeah. Yeah. With Nehor.
Nehor. Right?
Yeah.
In the first year of the reign of the judges, you have your first crisis under this new system.
Mm-hmm.
Nehor. Now, by the way, Nehorism, who knows when that arose? Did it arise under the monarchy? Under this new system, I assume now it's got some validity. It's a legitimate religious system. Doesn't mean it's right. I'm just saying it's legit. It's legally able to exist.
Yeah.
Right? And when you look at its doctrine, what I find intriguing about it is it's Christian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it's messianic. It believes in a being, and it's got a doctrine of redemption, which we haven't talked about, but that's that Nephite concern. So it's a Nephite-oriented doctrine of redemption, even if it's not a prophetic doctrine of redemption. Does that make sense?
Yes.
In fact, when you look at what Abinadi teaches about redemption, Abinadi teaches about submission and the importance of submission in being redeemed, and how you have to choose to submit to be redeemed. Nehor's doctrine, which we don't have a lot of, isn't that same type of redemption. So I've got two doctrines of redemption in the Book of Mormon now. I've got Nehorism and I've got Nephite Church. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
And these two are vying for religious popularity.
Yeah. What Niebuhr is teaching really is kind of a specific reaction against the system that's set up by Alma the Elder.
Yeah.
And who it teaches very much the opposite of what he's teaching. And so, again, this may be a push against that kind of Nephite religious authority.
Exactly. Right. And who knows? It could be Mulekite.
Yeah, it could be.
I think with that said, there is something to me in verse 3 about this popularity.
Yeah.
Now, I know that this looks as a negative. But what it does do is it would say it's up to the congregation to decide the leadership, not a top-down model.
Right, right. He's taken Mosiah's political statement, and he's using it for his purposes.
Yeah, exactly. Niebuhrism is able to expand under the new system precisely because it puts the onus on the people rather than established ecclesiastical hierarchy.
Right.
Which I find intriguing, right? Yep. For a biblical model, I think of Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam's reforms, right? When the kingdoms get split, Rehoboam stays. The temple is down there in Jerusalem.
So this is Rehoboam, son of Solomon, just so everybody knows. And this is when we get the split between the two kingdoms.
Yes, I probably should have explained that. So Jeroboam up in the north has a bit of a problem. He's politically separated from Judah down south.
Mm-hmm.
But religiously, they're still all attached to the temple.
Yep.
Right? So what does he do? He creates two new kind of religious centers, right? Mm-hmm. One in Bethel, one up in Dan. What I find fascinating is that he makes his priesthood, anybody can be a priest.
Yeah. Yeah. Which he removes the Levite element in there.
Yeah. But it also harkens back to an older version that should have been. In Exodus 19, mm-hmm. before Israel got involved and rejected the Lord, the original offer had been, I'll make you a kingdom of priests.
Yeah. Yep. Everyone.
Everyone could have been. So he sees himself as, I'm the true model, right?
Yeah.
But it was a true model where everybody could participate. It wasn't a hierarchical top-down model.
Right. Which is ideally, if we're all truly, honestly, fully connected to God, then that works.
Oh, of course.
But the problem is, we're not.
Yeah. I mean, the whole purpose behind the priesthood is, in fact, to help everyone become a part of the system.
Yep.
Right? But there's plenty of people that argue otherwise. I know for a fact there's plenty of people in the church, who are critics of the church that say it's a top-down model.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of that it comes from Christ, then I would say it is, and we like that it is because it comes from Christ, right? This is what Mosiah said, actually. If you can have a just king, well, that's what Christ is. Then this is good for you.
Exactly. And that actually is some of the irony, I think, behind the whole equity thing.
Mm-hmm.
Christ did, in fact, pay the price for everybody.
Exactly.
Right? But that only works if, in fact, you have a king that can do that.
Yep.
No human king can.
Yep. That's the profound element here, isn't it?
Right. And then connect that to Abinadi's teachings about redemption. And it's like, right. So I always look at this. Sometimes I've seen models where it's we provide nothing and Christ, we can only get back with Christ. And I agree to that. I agree to that. But Christ cannot make us do anything.
Right.
So if Christ takes care of 99.99999999999% of the problem, it's still not 100%. It requires that 0.000001 of my will saying, I'm going to let it happen.
Yep. Yep. I choose Christ. That's right. You have to make that choice, and God cannot and will not make you choose.
That's exactly
that
right.
Choice.
And that means salvation really is a joint effort between mm-hmm. us and God. Even if God takes care of the vast majority of the problem, which he does, I still have to choose him.
I have to turn my life over to Christ.
And only I can do that.
Yep.
Only I can do that.
Yep.
So
we have to give him a broken heart and a contrite spirit is another way of saying that, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And since we're just playing with that Hebrew word broken heart, right? That contrite. That's mm-hmm. dacha. At least it is in Isaiah 53, where we read mm-hmm. about it, that broken heart. To dacha, that when it talks about he was bruised for our iniquities in Isaiah 53, it's mm-hmm. the same root.
Yeah.
When what that suggests is what the type of sacrifice that Christ offered is the exact same type of sacrifice we're expected to offer. Yes. A full, complete offering of self.
Yep.
It's just a matter of scale.
Submitting our will to God's. That's exactly, exactly. Right. Yeah, it's a matter of scale. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a matter of scale. That's Nehor's. Now, he meets up with Gideon. Gideon's a bit of a hothead anyway. We've already known that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is that
Gideon. He's not going to give in, and he is going to act.
I know. I know that I shouldn't, but I don't know if you've ever seen The Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah.
You ever seen The Emperor's New Groove? And you know that old man that's like, I'm a rebel. That's how I see Gideon right now. He's older than this, but he's that feisty old man that's like, I'm not backing down. I'm like, you're going to lose against Nehor in a fight. You're just going to.
But he's still not going to back down.
But he's going to do it. He's a feisty old man. And he does get beaten. And so they go to blows. It goes to the sword and Nehor kills him.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got a problem. It's not a murder per se, or if it is, it's a murder in the second degree.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because Nehor did draw his sword first, according to this record.
Right. So now to that end, we run into what I see as our first political problem, verse 10. And the man who slew him was taken by the people of the church.
Yeah.
It's not a police force. If you're a follower of Nehor, whether you think he was right or wrong, is this problematic that a mob of church members took your leader?
Yeah.
Is this how we're actually going to do this, mob rule?
Yeah. And it's not the only time we see it, by the way. We see it later, but...
Right. This is an issue.
Yeah.
Right? Whoa. If it were today, we'd be like, whoa, you can't just do that. There cannot be mob justice in this. Now, so if you're a follower of Nehor, which again is legal, I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying it's legal. Would you look at this and go, wait a minute? And so the church members all bring him to Alma to be judged according to his crimes. Alma's the first chief judge.
Right. But he's also the religious leader. So it gets messy here.
Right. Again, if you're a follower of Nehor, you're like, what? No, this is wrong. This is not that legal system that we just set up 3 months ago.
Yeah.
But Alma said unto them, behold, this is the first time that priestcraft has been introduced among the people. All right. Okay. And behold, thou art not guilty of priestcraft, but hast endeavored to enforce it by the sword. Yeah. Priestcraft isn't wrong. Under a monarchy.
Or it's not illegal anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
I should rephrase that. Under a monarchy, it could be illegal. But under this new rule, it can't be.
Yep.
In fact, I find it intriguing that when Mormon talks about the legal system of the Nephites in Alma chapter 30, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sets it up, he doesn't actually go to the law of Moses. It's the law of Moses isn't it. Here's what he ends up doing. When he talks about that legal system, the Old Testament verse that he goes to is, for thus saith the scripture, choose you this day whom you will serve. That's Joshua.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And everyone can choose. That Joshua verse in Alma 30 is somehow now at center because precisely of this new law of equality and privileges and liberties.
Well, think of Joshua. He says that as he sets up the period of the judges.
Yes. So back to Nehor and Alma. All right. So priestcraft, not good, but not illegal. It's the enforcing it by the sword. And were priestcraft to be enforced among this people, well, then it would prove to be their entire bloodshed. If we're going to allow military might to supersede, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have a problem. We'll go right back to monarchy.
Yep.
Now, it talks about the shedding of blood, but I want you to look at verse 14. Therefore, thou art condemned to die according to the law which has been given unto us by Mosiah, our last king, and has been acknowledged by this people, the law, and therefore this people must abide by the law. Yep. He references that law twice explicitly, three times deliberately. This will go according to the law, you know, the one we all agreed to, that law.
Yep.
He's deliberately tying this back to this new system. I'm not doing it because I'm the high priest of the church. I'm not doing it because it's priestcraft. I'm doing it because this is the law that we all agreed to do.
Exactly.
This is him emphasizing that rule of law. But that crisis is already in the first year of the reign of the judges.
Yep.
And by chapter 2, I've got my first pro-monarchical movement, Amlicite.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. It was inevitable.
Right? And that's by the third year of the reign of the judges. By the ninth year of the reign of the judges, it's been so bad that Alma needs to do a regulation in the church. By the 11th year of the judges, you run into the Ammonihite destruction, the desolation of Nehor's, right?
Yep.
By the 16th year of the judges, I've got the immigration of the anti-Nephite Lehites into the land sparks the worst military conflict the Nephites have ever encountered for the past 500 years, according to Mormon. Mm-hmm. Not the worst that they're going to experience, but the worst to that moment. And by the end of the 17th, I have Korihor questioning all of this.
Yeah.
It is a messy, messy first 18 years of the reign of the judges. Which when I look at that, I can see people go, that was much better under our monarchy. Yeah. When you look at contemporary stuff, there was a movement when the USSR, right, broke up mm-hmm. and Russia becomes a quote-unquote representative government. There are plenty of people that said, no, I'd rather go back under the old system.
Yeah.
When you have such a switch over from system to system, this is really, really hard. And it can create a whole new set of hardships and struggles as everyone tries to figure out where's the power going to lie.
Yeah. And as people try and take advantage of it.
Yep.
Which also happened in Russia. But anyway, yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. We got, if I can, we got very lucky in this country.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We got very lucky the way things turned out. And yet we're still experimenting with it 300 years later.
Yeah. Yep. Amen. Well, Dan, thank you. That's, we could go on for more. We could talk about, you know, what does the judgeship mean and all the different roles that Mormon has together and parses out. And we could go on, but we probably better end here. But I'm grateful for the chance to explore this with you. Maybe we can especially leave people with that idea of our true and just King who did pay the price for our sins.
Yeah.
And literally thank God for that. And yet try and take the lessons we've looked at with this messy period of Nephite history and try and figure out how it might apply in our lives as we have different societies and cultures that we're integrating in the church, as we have all sorts of things going on in our lives. Let's learn from the mistakes. Let's also learn from the things that worked well. And hopefully this gives us a lens that allows us to do that as we continue to read in the Book of Mormon. I think you'll see more precepts or principles in a different way as you apply this lens to this reading and the readings that are coming for the next several months. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I think so. I've always wondered if, now granted it's coming from his son rather than Mormon, but when Moroni says, I've seen your day and I know you're doing.
Yeah.
He is talking to us.
Yeah.
And I think seeing in the Book of Mormon this emphasis, particularly in these very difficult years of massive transition of where identity is being questioned as to who we are and how we fit into the plan and what does it mean to be Israelite, right? I mean, Mormon's going to do such a great job. He bounces through these kind of large geopolitical issues. But then we're going to get the unbelievably powerful and poignant chapters where it's just Alma and his sons.
Yeah.
And some of these very issues that we're talking about, Corianne's got. Right?
Good.
What am I supposed to do with the church? How does this affect religion? It's all going to come back into play. And it becomes very personal and very individualized and very family-oriented as Corianne struggles with these exact same questions that we're talking about now.
Good. This is a lens that's going to help us a lot. So thank you so much, Dan. And I've been edified. I've been taught. I hope that our audience, I'm sure our audience has been, we hope that they'll share these ideas with others, talk with them in your scripture study with family, friends, groups, whatever else. Share some of the thoughts and ideas you've had online. If you've said, as I would guess you have, like 10 times, whoa, I never thought of that. Say something to your friends, say something online that's like, wow, this episode had me thinking in a way I never thought of. Help us spread the word and also do those like likes, rates, reviews, downloads, comments. The comments really help, all those kinds of things. But most of all, share with your friends and apply that lens yourself. We also want to invite you to come back next week as we do ALMA 5 through 7 with Dr. Andrew Skinner. So we'll have just a fun, wonderful discussion there, and we invite you to that. And I just want to say how much I've enjoyed this and how grateful I am. Thank you, Dan.
No problem. That's fun stuff. Can't beat the book.
That's right. That's right. All right. Thank you.
Take care. We'll see you.